This episode is brought to you in part by Adobe. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for designing, sharing, and prototyping experiences. Try the free beta today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more. This episode is also brought to you in part by Real-Time Board. Real-Time Board empowers distributed and co-located agile product teams to create the next big things. Visit realtimeboard.com/UD for your free trial and 25% off your paid subscription. Over a million UXers can't be wrong. Real-Time Board, Whiteboard. Finally in your browser.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 37. Today, I got to interview pro wrestler turned UX designer Andy Vitali. Andy is an old soul, if you know what I mean. And if you know me by now, you know I'm a huge proponent of empathy, and Andy has it in spades. You'll definitely feel that and be inspired to grow in your own empathy and design leadership as well after listening to him. Andy is leading a team at 3M Healthcare in some very important work in the medical field. More on that to come in my inspiring interview with Andy Vitali. Andy Vitali is a UX design principal at 3M, where he is focused on translating human insights into actionable experiences in order to improve the healthcare industry. He is responsible for leading a team that creates immersive, emotional experiences for 3M Healthcare's enterprise solutions. With 17 years of experience in the design industry, Andy has held multiple roles as a designer, entrepreneur, education department chair, and team leader. He's developed strategies and design solutions for diverse organizations ranging from startups to Fortune-ranked companies. He's a relentless user experience evangelist, I love that, driven by a shared vision and a user-centered passion. Fun fact, he was involved in the professional wrestling business for quite a long time, starting out as a wrestler and working his way behind the scenes. And not so fun fact, he was working at a company that suffered the first anthrax attack in the United States back in 2001. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but that's crazy. You are an interesting guy, Andy. Welcome to User Defenders. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Jason. I'm super excited to be here today.
So I definitely want to learn more about your wrestling story, and maybe you can tie that into your origin story. But every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. So sure. I'd like to start the show by you taking just a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Okay, so I mean, my personal life, that's a little different than my origin story for sure. My personal life is interesting to my team because they feel like I focus so much on design and writing and speaking and blogging, and every opportunity I get to do something, I'm saying yes, and I'm spending a lot of time doing that as well as working. So they feel like I don't have as much of a personal life as I should. So they've been kind of working on this design challenge with me as the problem per se, and they're trying to find hobbies for me.
They're trying to solve your design problem.
Exactly. And the hobbies have ranged from like the most weird things I've heard, like teaching horses how to fight, to like playing an instrument. But it's not, you know, as designers, it's not a normal instrument. It's a kazoo or a recorder or the bagpipes. It's something other than like a guitar or piano, what most people would learn.
So juice harp.
I'm really working on figuring out a hobby for myself. But in the meantime, like I really love like writing and just putting things together and working on advancing our team. So in my free time, aside from spending time with my wife, and we just adopted two chihuahuas. It's our third dog, actually. So
we had
a chihuahua that she's 9 pounds, and then we just got these two new little chihuahuas that are like 5 pounds each, and we got them a week ago, so it's been kind of awesome.
That's so cool, man. Chihuahuas are interesting canine creatures, aren't they? They're the cutest things, but they think that they are larger than life, don't they? And they're so tiny, but they think they are just all that. And we had a chihuahua, we've had a few, and they tend to only love family members. I don't know what it is. I don't know about yours, but ours, like, they hated anybody who knocked on the door or walked into the house that wasn't a family member and tried to bite them for it.
Yeah, our original one, she's like that. The two new ones, they're lovers. I think they're just happy to have a home now. So it's been great. When people come over, they love them too. So
that's special.
Hopefully that'll continue.
Yeah, maybe they'll rub off on the other one.
Yeah. Tell us your origin story, Andy. What inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
So I feel like much like everything else that's happened to me in life, it's been by accident. When I got out of school, out of high school, I went to college for TV and radio originally. So I had a radio show at, it was Brooklyn College in New York. And on my radio show, I tried to have different musicians or local celebrities. So I had a few friends that I met that became pro wrestlers through the show, actually. And I had a buddy of mine who kind of was in a rut in his life. He decided not to go to school. He was trying to figure out what to do, living in his family's basement. And we always, as kids, spent a lot of money going to the arcades and playing WrestleFest. And every Saturday, that's kind of what we did. And we grew up, we watched wrestling as often as we could. We loved it.
Oh, yeah.
So once I had wrestlers on the show, he came and sat in the studio for that. And it was a wrestler by the name of Chris Michaels, Mr. USA. He was an ECW tag team champion back when they were Eastern Championship Wrestling before they became Extreme Championship Wrestling. So he sat in on a show. And my buddy was like, man, I really want to train to be a pro wrestler. Like, that would be my dream. And Chris Michaels said, you know what? I really, like, I don't know you. I'm not going to train you. Like, they're guarded. He's like, but I'll train Andy. And if you want to come along for it, you know, you could learn too. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. But my buddy, like, begged me, like, come on, man. Like, this is my dream. This is our dream. Like, we could be a tag team. We could, you know, travel the world, be famous. Let's do this. So I was like, all right, let's give it a shot. So I dropped out of school and technically went to wrestling school, but it wasn't like a normal wrestling school. It was us paying like $10 to use a wrestling ring in a wrestling school when the main trainer wasn't there. So we would sneak into Gleason's gym in Brooklyn early on a weekday morning, and Chris Michaels would just like beat us up. Like, I mean, the only way you learn how to do things is to, you know, the way we learned how to take moves is to take the move. So it was really interesting because the ring was like a concrete floor with like piece of carpet on top of it. It wasn't very soft. And wrestling rings, people think there's like a big trampoline, but they're like inches thick of plywood with a little foam pad over them.
Oh, jeez. So
it's not super soft to land on.
Oh, man.
And, it, you know, you get headaches. And, I mean, it felt, it was terrible. It was like whiplash in the beginning until you learn to, like, tuck your chin and not bang your head on the floor. But Chris Michaels taught us enough to make him look good if we were to wrestle him. So we could get in the ring and he could beat us quickly. So the wrestling term for that are like jobbers or enhancement talent. And that's kind of what he trained us to be. He didn't train us to do a lot of offensive moves, but to make other people look good.
It sounds a lot friendlier than like, I'm going to beat you senseless so you learn things.
Exactly. If anybody's ever seen the movie The Wrestler, that's very much like the independent wrestling business. Like, there's not a lot of money until you really make it big. Wow. We wrestled in the worst buildings in New York, New Jersey. We would drive 7 in the morning. We'd get up, pick up a ring at somebody's house, show up at a venue, build the ring, go ahead and wrestle like one or two matches under a mask in a battle royal. Like, anytime they would throw us a bone, we would be like, yeah, we'll do it. At the end of the night, we'd have to tear down the ring, drive it back to the house. And, you know, they'd be like, well, here, we've got like $5 for you. So it wasn't glamorous and it wasn't profitable. But we figured, you know, like any other business, you've got to pay your dues. So I did it with him for like a year and a half before I decided to move to Florida. My family had all packed up and moved to Florida, and I was living in New York, and Florida didn't have a state tax, and I still had this dream like, yeah, I could maybe make it in wrestling. So I showed up in Florida and I wrestled a few shows, and the pay was still kind of like not great. And I decided, you know what? This isn't for me. Like, I'm not good at this. I'm not going to be like a huge star. I didn't go through like wrestling school and really like get a chance to hone my craft. And this is kind of as far as I want to take it. So what am I going to do with my life? I know I should go to school for something with computers. So there was this school called Kaiser College at the time that I went to in Florida, and they had the only computer options they had were graphic design or networking. And I was kind of like, you know what? I'm kind of creative. You know, in wrestling, you've got to be super creative with your character and the way you interact with people. So I said, you know what? Let me go for design. So I learned design. I fell in love with it instantly. I had a great teacher who taught us not only design theory, but how to use the tools. The tools have changed a lot since then. But I felt like that learning of the tools, aside from the foundational knowledge of design, was really helpful for me. And I immediately, like, how can I apply this to what I know, which is wrestling? You know, I met my wife in wrestling. She was a wrestling manager. She would come out to the ring, talk smack on the mic. So she was still in the business. She made it a lot further than I did. So I was like, well, let me help out. Can I make flyers? Can I, you know, edit some video? Can I shoot video? All the things that I was learning in design school, I was starting to apply to wrestling. So I ended up staying in and around the wrestling business for about 10 years. And it went to like promoting shows. And we had a show on the Sunshine Network, which is like a Fox Sports affiliate in Florida. So it was a wild ride, you know, going up and down the towns. Even if I wasn't performing in the ring, it was writing the storylines and figuring out how to get people sucked in to come back for the show again. So that was, you know, all of that helped me in design. But eventually, this was 2000 when I graduated from design school. So the web was still super new. Or at least a lot of the jobs that we had in Florida were not web-based, they were print-based. So I ended up, you know, taking a job in print, working for all sorts of different companies. Ended up learning digital kind of on my own as it was progressing. People like Jesse James Garrett, you know, I was reading everything that I could, making that transition to digital. And for me, the best way to kind of do that was, or to learn it, was to do it. So I did that until I ended up at that American Media, which was all of the tabloids. And at that point, which I'm sure we'll go into more detail later, when we had that anthrax attack, I was kind of like, I don't know what to do. So I went back to the school that I learned from because they had a teaching position open. And at that point, I had a few years in experience in the field. So I started to teach. And I was able to grow my teaching role from just a day and night instructor to eventually becoming the department chair, or at the time they were called program coordinators. And I was able to take that school and help it transition from a college, or from a career college to a university. And the design program is still existent in that university, that school system, but it's only at a few campuses. They used to have like 18 campuses throughout the state of Florida, and I believe they still do, but design is only at a handful.
Wow. You've got quite a backstory, my friend. They could make the wrestler movie out of you, and then wrestler turned designer. And there's a lot of interesting things and twists and turns that kind of brought you here. And I appreciate you filling in the blanks there for us. But I think about the wrestling thing, and his name is Chris Michaels. Like, I would have rather wrestled Bret Michaels.
Yeah, they almost looked identical.
Oh, jeez. I'm sure Chris was a little more bulkier.
He was at the time. Yeah. I would say a lot bulkier.
That's awesome. So who's been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
So, I mean, I feel like I've learned from a lot of people along the way, and I feel it's kind of hard to say who would be the biggest superhero, but if I had to pinpoint somebody, there is a lady named Raquel Cunningham who is actually, she works for a company called iCreatives. They do staffing. And early on in my career, I worked for a company called Renaissance Cruises, and they went out of business. They fired our whole department all at once. And I ran into Raquel when she was working with a company called The Creative Group, which is still in existence, a division of Robert Half.
Love The Creative Group.
Yeah, they're great people. So Raquel was instrumental in getting me some jobs early in my career. So what I liked about Raquel is she put me in places that would allow for me to learn. So they were like long-term contract positions. And if at any time I felt like it wasn't the perfect fit, I remember I was working for a company, a print shop at the time. This wasn't one that Raquel placed me at, but I got there and you had a clock in and out to record your time for almost everything you were doing, even bathroom breaks. At a certain time, there would be this bell that would ring, and like it was time for lunch. And
what if you had Taco Bell the night before?
I know.
Jeez.
You'd cost the company a lot of money in there. But like I remember at like 45, you had 45 minutes to eat lunch, and they would have a lunch truck. And after those 45 minutes, the door would lock. So you'd have to make it like public that you were late and had to get back in.
Oh my gosh.
So I had worked there for like a week, and I called Raquel on one of these lunch breaks, and I'm like, this is not the right fit for me. And she's like, we'll just leave then. And the very next day she had me somewhere else.
Oh wow.
And it was amazing. And she had gotten me a lot of experience early in my career and put me in the right place at the right time to learn from the right people and the right companies. Mm-hmm. And I probably owe everything in the early part of my career to her. So I would say she's been the biggest superhero. Along the way, I've had other mentors in and out of the design industry. But I mean, if I had to just pick one off the top of my head, it would be Raquel for sure. And now today there are other people that are influential to me. Mike Montero is another person. We had him out to speak at 3M. I got to spend a day with him and do some record shopping. Like he was really, I admire where he's taken design and his ideas around how design needs to be socially responsible. So if I had to pick one today, I would say that it would be Mike.
Wow. I love those answers, Andy, especially the fact that you gave just a shout out to your recruiter. I think that's so cool, man. I really do. One of my other guests, her name is Alexa Harazmchuk, and she wrote a blog post recently about being grateful, about, you know, thanks to that person that gave me my foot in the door, that opened that door for me, helped me get my foot in the door for the first job opportunity I had in product design. And she wrote a blog just really recognizing that person and taking a risk, you know, taking a chance. And I just appreciate that. I really do. And that's, it moved me. And it reminded me too, in the creative group is not sponsoring this episode, but they have been instrumental in my career too, man, which is really interesting. I mean, two of the best jobs I've ever had, I got because of the creative group. So shout out to them. Shout out to all the great people that work there. Keep doing that great work.
And a real funny story quick about Raquel is that I have not spoken to her in probably 7 or 8 years. I probably should send her an email, but her sister got married to the guitarist Mark Tremonti from Creed. Time early, they had gotten me like second row seats to Creed. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, Creed, they're a garbage band. I kind of love them.
Hey,
I tend to like a lot of cheesy things, cheesy music, cheesy movies, bad wrestling. Like, that's just my personality.
Hey, confession. I've got a couple Nickelback songs in my Spotify playlist.
Nice.
Hey, dude, those guys can write a power ballad. I don't like other rock stuff, but dude, they figured out the formula. Yep. You can even play their songs side by side and interchange lyrics, but that's nice. Awesome. And then Mike Montero, man, that guy, he has done a lot for design. I just wish he would kind of be a little more forthright about what he feels. You know? I wish he would just be a little more outspoken.
Yeah.
That's awesome that you got to spend the day with him, man. So this is great. Let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation. Now, as we know, every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. And we know significant transformation can occur through failure, as it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Could you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Sure. I think there are really two different transformations that I've had. The first transformation being when I was working for American Media, and we'll get into the Anthrax story now.
Okay.
So American Media is responsible for all of the tabloids. So Weekly World News, The Inquirer, The Sun, Star, Inquirer UK. And I was responsible for final pre-press output. So basically, the final versions of all of those publications had to go through me. And I remember it was a Wednesday or Thursday night, and they installed an intercom system, which we hadn't had at the time. And I was like, that's kind of weird, but okay. I wonder what they'll use that for, maybe announcements. And then I remember this Friday afternoon, maybe it was a Thursday. I don't remember it that vividly. That kind of the whole anthrax experience became a blur because I was so freaked out by it. But I remember they handed out this piece of paper when I got to work. So I used to work the like overnight shift. I'd go in at 4 and end whenever the printer said the files were good. But we got this like pamphlet that said that somebody that we worked with had come down with anthrax, and they think it was from a stream that it in North Carolina, and that everybody was safe. And they made the announcement over the loudspeaker the second I walked through the door, which, you know, now I'm trying to put like two and two together. Like, how's, you know, this is all tied together. What do they really know? And I'm like, you know what? I believe their story. And then I realized there are people like walking around in like hazmat suits. Like that's super weird.
ET.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, they weren't like directly in front of me, so I didn't really think anything of it. Who knows what they do in that building? We had this really cool like newsstand set up upstairs, and they were kind of looking around that area. And I remember being the last one out for the night that Friday for the weekend, and it was me and the security guard, and he followed me out. That following Monday, I got a call from my dad, and he was like, "Hey, man, you've got to get to the health department. Your company's on the news. They found anthrax all throughout your building." Oh, I'm like, "What? That's crazy." So, you know, nobody called me from the company, but my dad called me. He saw it on the news. So we went down to the health department and waited in line, and we had to sign this paperwork saying that, you know, the company will kind of treat us for this anthrax exposure, but we have to sign that we wouldn't sue them, like they're not responsible for this in any way.
So
we went down and we had our nose swabbed, and that was the main test for anthrax, to see, because it was inhalation anthrax, that the person, so somebody that person that contracted it eventually died from the anthrax attack.
Darn it.
And we ended up going to this hotel ballroom. And the FBI, the CDC, the Florida Health Department basically sat us down, gave us information about anthrax, and admitted to us, like, we honestly don't know what's going to happen to you. We don't know if you're going to be okay. What we're going to do is we're going to continue to monitor this, and we're going to give you 60 days of this medication called Cipro. The reason for that is there was an anthrax outbreak in Russia years ago, and the anthrax it lasted for 58 days. So they were going to give us 60 days of medication just in case it stayed dormant in our system. And I remember like freaking out, like another person got sick and ended up in the hospital for anthrax, but he survived. Jeez. He was one of our maintenance workers. But every time you heard like that news alert, that like breaking news, like people were freaking out. You'd find out that someone else that you work with was hospitalized. Luckily, I wasn't, but I remember going like every Wednesday, we'd go and get another swab, and they'd call us on Thursday and say everything's great, and then they'd call us back on Friday and say, you know what, the tests are inconclusive, we've got to do it again.
Jeez.
So at that point I was like, well, a lot of people stayed and worked for that company, they kind of switched to a different office, and I was like, no, I can't do that, it's not for me. And that's what drove me into teaching and then running that department, where I got to do a lot of like really honing the craft, learning new things to teach the students, really focusing on digital. So that was my exposure to digital. And then at the same time, I started an agency with four friends of mine. At the time, design jobs in Florida were not paying well. They were not really great environments. It was still very print-based. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I'm in the wrong field. Maybe I should go into something in healthcare. Maybe I should be a doctor. Well, I didn't want to be a doctor, but maybe I could be a nurse. So I went back to school to get like an undergrad in pre-nursing. And at the time I was doing that, I had these friends that were like, hey, you know what? We're going to start this agency. We were all kind of working out of a co-working space. And I was like, you know what? I'll jump in on this because I've got a lot of experience in design, and I can help with a lot of the print stuff and the web stuff. And it was a really awesome group of people. So we started an agency, and we debated over the name for a while. We called it the Pancake Movement eventually. We just kind of sat in this diner brainstorming on names. And I remember, I think it was Chili Willy, the cartoon. And I was like, so burnt out at that point from spending all day trying to come up with a name, that I was just like, pancakes, pancakes. So at that point, we're like, let's just buy that domain. So we bought moonpancakes.com, and we had another guy that's like, it doesn't sound really good enough. We want to do something forward facing. So we're like, how about movement? So we turned it into the Pancake Movement, and it was kind of cool. We started in a co-working space. Our first client was BlackBerry. We helped them launch a lot of tools in South America because we had that, being in South Florida, we had that connection there. We ended up outgrowing the co-working space we're in, moving in with this other photographer, and that's a story for another day. That dude was crazy. He was like Keith Richards. Like, he had models everywhere, and there were drugs. It was crazy. Man. Like, we were renting some of his space, and then in the back area where we were was this other awesome company called Splinter Studios. It was this dude, Dean Lyon, who was the special effects director for all three Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh my gosh.
And to this day, I still haven't seen them, so Dean's still a little bitter at me, and I promise, Dean, if you're listening, I will watch them one day.
Just watched the whole trilogy with my kids recently.
Did you?
Yeah. Right.
I definitely have to watch that.
So good.
So We ended up growing at a decent pace. A lot of characters in South Florida, a lot of people that don't really, they don't follow through on paying. So it caused a lot of tension. We ended up getting our own space in this up-and-coming area called Fat Village, where there's a lot, it's like a Florida Arts and something. I don't remember exactly what it stands for, but it was in the early days. Now they do a lot of like art walks and everything. So We got to the point where there was a lot of tension between the designer wanted to, you know, branch out and do other work, and the developer and the designer were buddies, and the person that was doing a lot of our biz dev was like, you know what, I'm a designer too, I don't want to only do biz dev, and was conflicting with the designer, and it became a tense situation. And then the designer and developer left and started their own thing, moved across the country, and it was me and this other guy. But that's really where I got into UX. Like, I was doing a lot of reading on it, but I hadn't had a chance to actually apply it until we had the agency. So roughly like 2009 is when I really started to do user experience work for customers or clients. And we ended up closing that agency, which technically is a failure. I mean, I hate to use the word failure. A lot of people talk about learning, you know, fail fast, fail often. I'm not about failing at all. I'm about learning from your mistakes early enough that it doesn't get to the point where it fails. And I've been applying that through a lot of things here at 3M. We never want a project to fail. We want to be able to learn from the mistakes early and pivot and make things better. But back to the agency, I mean, when we closed the doors, that's kind of a failure for the business, but it launched me into my next job, which was kind of doing mobile UX stuff at Office Depot. And it was a great time to be at Office Depot because it was 2010, so Passbook was coming out, PayPal integration, social login, a lot of things were happening in mobile that we were able to integrate into Office Depot's mobile apps relatively quickly, and we got a lot of recognition from Apple for it and a lot of attention for it. Just to move that story a little bit further along, when I was at Office Depot, my wife at her job, she slipped on a marble floor that was wet and broke her foot clean in half.
Oh my God.
And had to have two surgeries in Florida, and it still didn't heal properly, and we ended up having to move to North Carolina so she could see the NFL doctor for foot and ankle injuries, and he did a great job, and she's like 100% mobility now. Wow. But if that didn't happen, I still might be at Office Depot. Like, who knows?
Wow. Dang. So the failure really is, and I totally get what you're saying. Failure is not a bad thing, and that's why I kind of bring it to light here on this show. But I think the failure, like you said, was just in having to close the shop.
Right.
But again, like you said, that quote unquote failure of having to do that led to even greater things, right? For you.
Right.
And
exactly.
Moving into like where your calling was, like being able to,
right,
to realize your calling.
Exactly. So. And it brought me to 3M, which has really been my greatest opportunity. So I'm really happy about everything that's led me to this moment in time.
That's so cool. What do you want our listeners to take away from that story, Andy?
That I don't believe in failure as a whole. Even if your product comes out and it's not ready for the market, there's a few reasons. Maybe your idea is so good the market's not ready for it. And sometimes your execution might be off. But it's really important to learn from your mistakes and figure out a way to take that learning and apply it to something even greater. Mm.
That's great. Do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing by chance?
You know, I wouldn't say anything really crazy or awkward. We do a lot of user testing this wouldn't be user testing. This is more like contextual inquiry and observations on site at hospitals.
Yeah.
So we see a lot of things that we don't really want to see. Oh. At one point, we were in somebody's office, and their office was right outside an operating room, and were a trauma center. So,
oh boy,
we saw, you know, a lot of things that we didn't want to see. A lot of people being rushed in for surgery.
Oh goodness.
And I mean, thankfully we didn't get a full glimpse of what was happening, but yeah, you know, you could feel the tension and what was happening and the panic and. It wasn't comfortable.
Sure.
Aside from that, I mean, most of our user testing sessions, if they're moderated, the only awkward thing that happens is sometimes we have somebody from the business that's a subject matter expert that accompanies us. And instead of letting users kind of just do what they're doing so we could learn from their flow, they're quick to jump in and be like, hey, no, you should do it this way. And that puts us in this awkward situation of trying to, like, we have to scold our business partners in front of our customers. But I mean, as designers, we've got to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations and just take charge.
Yeah.
So that's the most awkward thing, is when you have to put somebody that you work with in their place that's a little uncomfortable and awkward.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing that. And I'm glad. I appreciate you not going into too much detail about the traumas.
Yeah.
Speaking of hospitals, what exactly are you doing at 3M with the healthcare industry? Now, are you working on the hospital experience at all, or is it more on like the insurance side of things? Or tell us more, like, and fill us in on kind of what you guys are doing and what you're trying to accomplish there.
Sure. So when I started on our team, I was the second UX person at 3M, especially, and healthcare is where UX is at 3M right now.
Yeah.
So originally, I was working on projects across all six divisions of healthcare. So it's infection prevention division, which is a lot of like monitoring cleanliness in hospital settings or medical devices. Then there's oral care solutions. So it's products and digital software for dentists and orthodontists. We make our own version of like braces that go inside your mouth, like Invisalign, called Incognito. And then from there, we've got drug delivery systems. So we make inhalers, microneedles, smart transdermal patches. We're coming out with a smart inhaler. I think it's launching in 2019. Anytime there's medical devices, there's a long process to get them to market. We've got critical and chronic care, which right now are a lot of creams. So we make a lot of sales tools for them. And then there's food safety. So all of the different testing that goes on for food to make sure that it's safe to consume, we have testing methodologies and equipment for that. And then we've got our health information systems division, which focuses on enterprise software. So when I started, if you think about all of those different divisions, every person in the world is one of our customers. So it's somebody that we're designing for. Everybody eats food. Everybody knows somebody that has braces or goes to the dentist. Hopefully everybody goes to the dentist. So we were designing for pretty much everybody. It's a B2B situation. So we're designing for, like, at that point, the dentist. But because these braces go in a patient's mouth, you know, it's also affecting patients. But our health information systems, where we really play, this is our team grew from I was number two to we're now 15. So we've kind of branched out to have a separate team that I lead to focus on our enterprise software solutions. And what that is it's a lot of software that nurses use. Some doctors use it. Definitely medical coders. And then also like quality users in hospitals. So if you think about a patient encounter, an inpatient encounter, you go into the hospital, there's a lot of doctors that you see, and there's a lot of documentation that is associated with your encounter or visit or series of visits. So we create software that takes that documentation through natural language processing, and it recommends a code, a billable code for the medical billing team. And then the coders and these nurses that are looking at different clinical information while the patient's still in the hospital to make sure things are going in the right direction, but also figuring out how to set up this billing hierarchy based on a DRG, which is what the insurance companies use to group scenarios in hospitals. So we're creating software that's kind of streamlining that. And some of the work we've done in inpatient has really increased productivity. But in outpatient, we just released today a new version of our software that from our initial testing, we've seen an increase in productivity of about 30%. So if you talk about somebody that's working on maybe 60 cases an hour, if you're increasing that by even 25%, that's 15 extra cases an hour. That's over 100 cases a day, which adds up to a lot of money, a lot of extra money that the hospital is sending bills out for. So it's really this enterprise stuff. And there's a lot of little intricacies along the way of how nurses communicate to the physician to make sure that the documentation is right. So it's really understanding all of the key players in the hospital or in the care pathway of the patient while they're in a hospital to make sure that we're having that data not be a barrier for anything in the patient's care, but also along the way help the hospital and the insurance companies with the billing.
You guys are doing some important work. I mean, you're literally dealing with life. You're trying to solve a really big problem, and that's keeping people alive. So I commend you. I commend you and the team for that work, and I really encourage you to keep fighting on, as I say.
And it's been so rewarding.
I can imagine so. I'm going to tell you something. The first part of your answer had to do with helping hospitals fight infection. And I want to just share, like, that really hit home with me personally. And I'll tell a quick story here of why. 3 years ago, actually is almost 3.5 years ago, we found out we were pregnant with our sixth child, believe it or not. And we found out also shortly after that there was a problem in he had a malformed growth in his lung that that was starting to compress his heart and his other lung, his vitals, and it was rapidly growing. And so we found that out through ultrasound, and ultimately it came down to two choices. One, my wife could just wait it out. We could wait it out as a family and just kind of hope that he'll outgrow the growth, you know, in the womb.
Right.
The other choice was that she could have open fetal surgery.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you may have seen those pictures where the little baby's hand is sticking up through the womb and the doctor
right.
and grabbing the doctor's finger.
Yeah.
And those are very rare. Those are very rare, typically for infants with spina bifida. And so the doctor, we had one of the best surgeons who actually invented this. He was one of the inventors of this procedure. We actually were able to, we were talking to him about this. Basically my wife, bless her soul, brave soul she is, she chose to undergo open fetal surgery to try to save his life. And so she did that. And that means they go into her womb and into him while he's in utero to remove that. And they did that. It was a success. And they sealed him up, sealed the womb up, replaced the water, and then sealed her up. And then, but anytime that happens, there's 100% chance of premature birth, no matter
right.
what, because they're just disrupting nature. They're disrupting, what's down there. So that is totally normal. We expected it, but in, 10 days later after the surgery, which was a success, they got that growth out and things started looking better for him. 10 days later, she went into labor and delivered our son, and sadly he caught an infection. He was sepsis, blood infection, and sadly he died the next day.
Oh man, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. So that one hits home for me, man. And I just, as somebody who has impacted very greatly by that, I mean, we've never experienced anything harder than that. I just encourage you guys to keep trying to solve that problem.
Right. We definitely will continue to keep trying to do that.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah. Just, her water broke. Right. And that was the thing. And that the water, I mean, God's an intelligent designer and he designed the body, for women to have that sac to protect the baby from infection. And once that water breaks, which is what happened for her, there's just a lot of susceptibility, to those things. And, and doctors are really great. The medicine has been really great at helping to keep a woman, from delivering after the water breaks. But unfortunately there's that susceptibility and that's a really big problem to solve. So I'm sorry, I took up so much time with that, but I just felt like that impacted me directly, and I just encourage you guys to keep fighting on in that, in everything else you're doing.
I definitely appreciate hearing that story because it's something that if I don't touch directly, someone on my team does have the ability to touch that. So anything I could share to help them, become more empathetic to the situation, because that probably hasn't happened to them. Almost positive. So that a story like that really helps us continue to inspire us to keep fighting for what we're fighting for.
Nice, man. Awesome. So, let's see, where do we leave off here? So what's your design superpower, Andy? I know you have quite a few there.
Right now I want to say flying to Salt Lake City in 2.5 hours every other week, but no, in all seriousness, I think design is my design superpower.
Huh.
I feel like I use design like it's the force. I use it to make me almost like a snake charmer. Right. And maybe that ties back to wrestling too. Like it's being able to tell a story, being able to work an audience or a crowd and being able to adapt on the fly if something goes wrong. I mean, we use design to start talking points sometimes to be persuasive. As designers, we're storytellers. So design is the biggest piece of that storytelling ability that we have. I mean, really, it's become our main tool. I'm trying to think of a better way to communicate that. But I mean, realistically, we use design to influence people.
Yeah. Well, I just told you my story and it inspired you to want to even pass that on to the folks who are working specifically on my problem and what was ended up being a really big problem for us. And so I think that's kind of a kind of a simple way to kind of sum that up is you're right. Design is about storytelling. It's about listening too. It's about listening to our customers, listening to the people we're designing for and their pain points, their problems, and really translating that into a solution, a tangible solution that will help improve their lives, right?
Exactly.
So I love that you said that design is your design superpower. That's cool.
Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for creating beautiful, interactive user experiences for websites and desktop or mobile apps. Adobe XD helps you design, prototype, and even share your experiences with your teammates and stakeholders for feedback. Try the free beta for Mac or Windows today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more. Create, co-design, and collaborate, building your workflow around a single tool. Real-time board, an endless online whiteboard for enterprise-level visual collaboration. With Real-time board, you can collect references, work on user story maps, customer journey maps, create wireframes, and get feedback on designs using this simple visual collaboration platform. Take your UX process to the next level with Real-time board. It's there for you every step of the way, from research and ideation to visualization and review. Visit realtimeboard.com/UD to start your free trial and get 25% off your purchase of a paid subscription. Real-time board. Whiteboard, finally, in your browser.
What's your design kryptonite, Andy?
So kryptonite, I don't... So That's a really good question, because I don't feel like there's much kryptonite for designers. So of course there are things that weaken us, right? There are company or people within the company that are not as receptive to design. I mean, take a look at 3M. It's a 100-plus-year-old company, and traditionally it's been driven by marketing and R&D and the lab, and you know, it's been super successful and profitable without design. So how do we come into the picture and really like influence them? So the kryptonite might be people that aren't as receptive to design as we'd like, but that's our biggest opportunity at the same time. It's about educating these people and showing them how design adds value. And once you really show people the value that design adds, they get on board instantly. It's magical. Mm. And at 3M across the board, there are definitely people that have been here and done things without involving design. And sometimes they're reluctant at first because design sometimes slows them down or makes them rethink their problem or causes more work for them. But it's a little bit more work up front for a greater result in the end. Even in our health information systems division, we've got a little bit of kryptonite where they went through a full agile transformation but haven't had a design presence in that. So when we show up and we're like, hey, we're here to really help you, they've got 87 different scrum teams and we've got 4 designers. So how do we make an impact that way? It's almost impossible. We can't be spread that thin. So it's like, okay, well, why don't we start to validate larger stories for you before you start to design them or before you start to build them, so that we can make sure that they're the right solution for the customer. Mm. So they're like, okay, that's great, but we've got to build it next week and you're going to slow us down. So it's really figuring out how to integrate in that situation too. So can we have a sprint, or can we start with some sort of discovery sprint and do research and call it a sprint and align on terminology so that we're all marching towards that same goal and speaking that same language? Because that's the key. Everybody has their own process. We've got a design process. There's a new product integration process. There's a development process. We can't have all of these separate processes. We've got to integrate them all so that there's one process. And the only way to do that is to leave the designer speak and the designer ego at home and just kind of have one common language. So our kryptonite is really our biggest opportunity.
How in the world do you guys manage timelines? You are designing products that are literally meant to help people stay alive. Like how are you guys, like, cause obviously you're still, even though you're designing some very important things for healthcare, you still have project managers. I'm sure you still have deadlines. How does that work? I mean, right. Cause I mean, I said it on another interview that I had with Samuel Hulick. I said, you know, do you want it right or right now? And that's often what it has to do with. And when the stakes are this high, how do you mitigate that?
So every project is really different, and every project team is run as its own business here. And in the beginning, when I was just one of 2 designers on the team, as opposed to now where I kind of have a team, I was responsible for a lot more projects. I would say at one point I was on maybe 12 at one time, and everything ranging from like crafting a digital strategy for a division to like day-to-day, like the sales team needs a tool to communicate quickly with dentists when they're in their office and they only have a minute. So really there are so many separate timelines. Luckily for me, this enterprise software division that we have, our health information systems division, they have taken the true meaning of like agile and scrum, and they're just constantly chipping away at improving things. So there's no like set deadline, like this needs to be done next week. It's like, this is a problem we have to solve. Let's figure out the way to solve it and then break it up so that the development team can incrementally add it to our customers. A lot of the software that we have already exists and we're improving upon it. We do have some new software coming out. The only thing I can say about one of the new things that are coming out is we've partnered with Verily, who used to be Google Life Sciences, for a population health management software. And there is a website, or you could Google that partnership. I don't know what I can and can't say, what's public yet. Sure, so I'll just kind of leave it at that. But
that's fine.
That is kind of, since that's a new product, we have a roadmap and a series of these kind of deadline items that we have to deliver to launch. But aside from that, you know, we're launching. It's funny, the development team used to call things an MVP, and the developers I work with, I've learned to kind of change that. I want them to really have an emotional connection to their project. So I saw Maria Guidis from Autodesk speak at Enterprise UX, and she talked about a minimum lovable experience, and she compared it from like this cake with no icing to like a cupcake that's perfectly crafted, but it's smaller and people love that more. And I've used that analogy to really sell them on minimum lovable experience. So we want to make sure that what we're launching isn't just good enough. It's got to be desirable and solve a customer problem.
Love that. That's really great, Andy. And you know, you guys are 3M. It's funny. 3M stands for Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company.
Yes.
It's so funny. And this is something I learned in design when I was taking some design courses early in my career. I had one teacher who was really the most inspiring teacher. He just like had so many stories about design. And this was one story. And I still remember, this is 24 years ago, somewhere around that. It was a long time ago. And I still remember him mentioning 3M. And the fact that it's like a company that stands for mining, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, yet they've created the Post-it note.
Right.
Like that's like to me, like that talk about a spirit of innovation. And I think that's cultural. And it goes top down and it kind of spreads throughout the company. And so I just want to, you know, just mention that because I just think that's such an interesting story that a company that originally was known for mining and manufacturing various things ends up being like a huge player in healthcare and creating Post-it notes, which for the love of Pete, like, I mean, who doesn't use those in their UX? Which designer doesn't use those in their exploration and research? So I just think that's really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing how many products 3M has out that people don't even realize. Like our big brands, right. Even Ocello sponges are like a 3M product. But what really brought me to 3M and brought that to my attention was their investment in design. We have a chief design officer who's on the VP level. So he's got that seat at the executive table. And then they've also invested in a new design center that all the designers in the US are co-located, which is an amazing space. But it's that philosophical and financial investment to design that really, like, when I came here, I was like, this is the place for me. This is where I could really, you know, help build something important. And it's been a great experience for me.
So cool. And that's how design stays visible. You have a really key player at the table that's advocating for the work you guys are doing and keeping you guys visible and relevant and probably creating some really great opportunities. Yeah. That's great. Hat tip to that guy.
Yeah. Eric Quint, our chief design officer.
Nice. I think the good news is that that's becoming more and more common at companies. Thank God.
Hi, I'm Jordan Dobson. I'm a design prototyper, and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
This is a fun question, and I always caveat this with this question with the fact that I know you didn't get where you are on your own, and I know you've surrounded yourself with some great people that have helped propel you to where you are today, Andy. But I do want to ask this because it's a fun one, and it's certainly even superheroes have Justice Leagues, right?
Right.
So I want to ask you, what would your UX superhero name be?
Oh man, if I had to think off the top of my head, I would go with the UXecutioner.
And ooh.
The reason I say that is
I like that.
I don't mean it in the like chopping people's heads off kind of way, but it's in the getting things done type of way.
Sure.
Really, like the key to our success has been to execute. People could talk about things all day long, but until you have something to show, it's not believable to them. So what we've been doing is, you know, it's 3M is a, a lot of smart people, a lot of busy people. So if you're going to try to email them and pin them down, you might not get a response right away. So sometimes you have to do a little bit of pre-design work, understand the context and kind of put a little vision together and use it as a talking point to make sure you're going in the right direction. And even, you know, we're fortunate enough that I could sketch something with one of my product owners in a hotel lobby on the way to going to a customer, and he'll say, hey, show these guys what you just sketched out, because let's get their feedback that early to see if we're going in the right direction. Wow. And we've been doing that. We were on this little bit of a road show as we're trying to improve some of our software. And I mean, we've showed them all different types of fidelity product, like, you know, wireframes, early sketches, clickable prototypes, to as we increase fidelity, you know, as we validate things along the way. So it's, I feel like execution is like the biggest thing here. So I would, that's why I immediately thought like you executioner. That's awesome to me.
Wow. I love that. And that is so great. It just has a nice ring to it. And oh man, that's fun. So one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, I fight for the users. And you've talked, I think you have touched a little bit on how you do it, but if you want to add anything else, how do you fight for your users, Andy?
I just show up. I like to call it bringing my own seat to the table, but a lot of times early in projects, design is still kind of like brought in, maybe not at the right time or early enough. I mean, that's changed. When I started, I would say it was more likely because our team was still small and growing and design was new. So we would just show up. And when you just show up, it throws people off. Luckily, I'm in Minnesota now, and Minnesota nice is a real thing. People are pretty passive aggressive, so nobody's going to say, get the hell out of here. You don't belong here. You weren't invited. They let you sit down. Now, in doing so, you've got to be careful. You can't just blurt things out or telling them they're doing things wrong, because they're the experts. We have to understand that as designers, that we're not subject matter experts on everything, and we're not the end user, just like we say they're not the end user. So it's about showing up and speaking at the right time and saying, well, have you spoken to users? What do users think about this? What feedback do you have from users? What problem is this solving for the users? And just advocating for them all the time. I mean, sometimes you show up and people are like, oh, the designer's here. Like, we don't want him around, or let's make sure he can't see our calendar invite. But that has changed. I mean, just from showing up and really advocating for users has helped them rethink the way they're strategizing their projects, and just show up and fight for them. That's all you can do.
I love it. Yeah. And you guys are, I've read some of the articles and things out there. I mean, Fast Company Design republished an article written about the culture there of design, and you're a big part of that. And so I know that you take this seriously. These aren't just words. This is words that reflect actions that you take, and you're doing this stuff every day. So I know that this is a reality for you. And I know a big part of it too is customer journey maps.
Yes.
Right. And it's integral to kind of how you guys learn about your users and the problems that they're facing. Like, can you touch on what a customer journey map is and why it's beneficial?
Sure. So for us, our journey map is this visual layout of the customer journey. So the workflow, and it's identifying the key users in that workflow, the touch points that they have, and their emotions that are attached to every step of that journey. What we try to do is map that out first with stakeholders to get their understanding of where they think the customers fit, what they think that customer workflow is, what they think the customer feels about interacting with our products. And we take that and we just keep it. Then we go out to customers and we observe what they do, and we talk to them, and we understand the actual customer journey, what their workflow is, what their emotions are attached to each step, what their pain points are, what their needs are. Our stakeholders are really good at understanding the pain points and needs of the user, but they're not the greatest at solving the larger problems. What they like to do is just pile a little feature on top of another feature. They're not looking at the overall picture. So that journey map really helps them understand the larger view. And then we come back with the journey map we created with the customer, and we compare it to the one we made with the stakeholders, and we identify those gaps between the two. And that's kind of the first place that we start to attack. And our stakeholders are like, wow, I never realized that. I didn't realize that their workflow was so different than our intended workflow. And that's really eye-opening, and that really gives us good leverage to start to design customer first.
Ah, that's so good. I know our defenders listening are tuning in, especially for that part of just learning more about their customers and even looking into customer journey maps. And it's kind of another nod to storytelling, right?
Right.
Because it's really their story is what matters.
Exactly.
The most, right?
It's really about helping them tell their story, even the business story, and being able to influence it too so that it's most beneficial for our users.
Yes, it's that fine balance, right? The customer in the business. So let's wrap up the show with imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success, you executioner?
Okay. So I would say that it's got to be stamina. It's the grind. It's the hustle. I'm always busy. I'm always working on multiple things. I'm outworking people if I can, right? Because I might not be the greatest designer in the world. I'm not. There are definitely better designers than me. But I will put in the time to make sure that my results are as good as anybody else's. And that's kind of from the execution part. The manager side of me, probably the best thing that I have that contributes to success as a manager is understanding the value of people on my team and understanding their needs and their motivations. It's really important when you have a team to understand like what drives them, what do they see as success? Is it work-life balance? Because if it is, then I will make sure that you're not on a 10 o'clock call with a development team in another country. If you're here just to use 3M as a stepping stone, which I hope you're not, but if you are, I want to know that so I could give you the best projects to help you elevate yourself. And at the same time, you can help elevate the projects that you're working on. And then you also have to know that people change over time and that motivation changes. Somebody might start out as a single person and want to work extra time and really grind it out and get a lot of successes in early to help grow the team. Then before you know it, they're a parent and they want to get home and they want to go and spend time with their kids, which is great. So you have to, as a manager, understand these things and understand that the drivers for your team change over time, and you have to be able to have this relationship with them that you understand their goals and help them reach those.
Stamina, defenders. I love that. Another way to say that would be grit.
Yes.
And it's a hat tip. That's a nod to the book. I just actually am almost done reading that book called Grit.
Okay.
By Angela Duckworth is her name, I believe. Yeah. She wrote that book. She's a psychologist. It's so good. It's so inspiring. And that's exactly what you made me think of, Andy, in that response. And I appreciate your humility too. Like, you're like, I'm not the best designer in the world, but you know what? I'm going to outwork you. I'm going to work hard on this. And you know, it's funny. It made me think of a quote from Will Smith that Angela mentioned in her book Grit. And I'm going to share it right now. I just looked it up real quick, and it's really, I think it's really inspiring and relevant to your response there, Andy. He says, "The only thing that I see that is distinctly different about me is I'm not afraid to die on a treadmill. I will not be outworked, period. You might have more talent than me. You might be smarter than me. You might be sexier than me. You might be all those things. You got it on me in 9 categories. But if we get on the treadmill together, there's 2 things. You're getting off first, or I'm going to die." It's really that simple.
That's great. That, you know,
isn't that a great one?
That's a funny story that my boss was on a treadmill one time, and I've definitely not spent my time in the gym lately and have gotten a little more out of shape than I'd like to admit, but I would not get off that treadmill until she was done. I would have died on that treadmill if I had to.
Oh, man, that's inspiring. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
You know, it's got to be, for me, it's people. I feel like people are super inspiring to me, and I'm always learning from them. And as our team grows, I feel like I can't say there's a specific site, a specific blog or book, but it's just that knowledge that comes along when you have somebody new on the team and they just share what they know and make a recommendation of a book, of a blog. Somebody just recommended to me a book by a friend of mine, Tom Griever, called Articulating Design Decisions. That was a wonderful thing that I picked up along the way from somebody. Another thing, if we talk about people, that's helps inspire me is we get interns every summer, and the interns, when they come here, it's so refreshing to see these students that are really wide-eyed, super optimistic about design. They bring this fresh perspective to things. I really feel like that's my favorite time of year when we have interns here, because as much as I like to mentor them and teach them, I feel like I learn from them, and I learn lots of different things from them, even musical recommendations that help me work a little bit better, something to throw on and listen to while I'm working. So really people and learning from others is the most inspiring UX resource there is.
Love that, Andy. That's such a cool answer. And I have to agree with you. We have just this longing to connect with people, right? And it's built in, and it's necessary, and we have this longing to connect, and I think that people inspire us, right? And we would I just read that quote from Will Smith that inspires me,
For sure.
And so I totally get that too. Being around a fresh new designer, somebody who's just you said, wide eyed and just so hungry to just jump in and just learn everything. That's inspiring to me, and that's kind of honestly those are the people that I especially love talking to and especially love reaching with this show, because they're just soaking it like sponges, and I have kids, and I just it's amazing to me how much they love learning. And so there's kind of that fresh perspective, like you said. So I love that answer, Andy. That's
hunger
awesome.
From younger designers is what kept me in design when I thought about leaving to go into the healthcare profession. When I was working with my partners in the agency, and they had that that hunger and drive, that was contagious. And I've picked that up and learned to love design again, and I haven't let go of that love ever since.
Ah, so cool. Well, in addition to Articulating Design Decisions, which I have the book and I need to read it, Tom, sorry, I think Tom's a listener. I'd love to have you on the show sometime, Tom, after I read your book. But in addition to that book, what's one book you would recommend to our listeners and why?
So I've got a friend of mine, Denise Jacobs, who I met when I was in South Florida. She's got a book coming out called Banish Your Inner Critic. And it's a book for designers for sure, but it's also a book for non-designers. It's about silencing that self-doubt that we all have and unleashing creativity so that we can do our best work. All of us feel like we're stuck in a rut, or we have that self-doubt or that sometimes imposter syndrome. That's real for designers, but that's also real for non-designers. So as designers, this book is great. It's got little tips and tools to really help think about things differently and get that creativity flowing again. It's not out yet. It's coming out in June, but there is a website that you can pre-order, and it's innercriticbook.com. And I really, if you haven't seen Denise speak, and she's pretty much spoke everywhere. One time I actually had to speak after her at a WordCamp event in South Florida, and it was my first speaking experience, and Denise went on was amazing. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to bomb this. There's no way I could even come close. And I was awful. It was my first time. But afterwards, Denise came
sure
over to me.
I'm sure it wasn't that bad, Andy.
I'm sure it was, but I appreciate that. Afterwards, I was super down on myself, and I saw Denise in the hallway, and she's like, how'd it go? And I'm like, going on after you was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And she's like, I'm sure it was great. Just, keep doing it. She continued to inspire me at that point. And again, that's back to people, and everyone you encounter has something that you can really take and grow from. So I would recommend her book. I think it's good. I've read the pre-release, and it's amazing. So
Oh, so cool. I'm so glad you mentioned that, Andy. And I haven't heard of it yet, so I appreciate you mentioning I feel like we get a nice little teaser into something to look for, and I'm definitely going to read that book. That's something I struggle with too. And like you said, the more you get out there, the more you put yourself out there, the more comfortable you get. And that's the thing, like I use that word really loosely because we never want to get too comfortable.
Right.
We never want to get too comfortable. I think we still, if we don't have any nervousness or any sort of anxiety or nerves before we go and kind of put ourselves out there, I question whether we're doing our best work.
Right.
So I feel like there's really good takeaways in that, Andy, and I just love your humility, man. So thanks a lot.
Yeah.
What's your best advice? This is my last question for you, man. What's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
Be persistent. Do not take no for an answer. Continue to drive things forward and really value the user, because the people are going to say no throughout your career or tell you that that's not the right direction or anything they could tell you. You know, they're going to tell you the users might not like that. Then be persistent and say, well, you know what? Let's ask the users. The key is that persistence. It's the only way to grow. It's the only way to really make progress on things, to get other people aligned with what you're doing. If you just kind of roll over and listen to everybody and go back to like being a service, then you're not really providing as much value as you could. And you have to let people know that you could be adding more value if you were doing things differently. If you let designers do their job and do design and focus on users, then there'll be greater results. So just don't be a pushover. Be persistent.
Oh, love it. Well, Andy, I could go on for an extra hour, and I know we're already over, and I appreciate you staying on longer. But as we close, man, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
Sure. So I don't have a website right now. I've got to kind of build that. So hopefully that will happen soon. I'm on Twitter.
Same here, brother.
I don't, you know, it's always like our own personal stuff is always like last, but on Twitter.
Cobbler's son has no shoes.
Exactly. On Twitter at Andy Vitale, LinkedIn, Andy Vitale, everywhere else. My Instagram is just food photos. I've been speaking a lot about culture. I'm hoping to turn it into a workbook really soon. So hopefully that will start to fall into place and happen. But really just, I would say Twitter is probably the best way to follow me and stay in contact with me and interact with me.
Awesome. Andy, you've been so gracious. And again, I think I keep saying your humility is inspiring me, and I hope it doesn't give you a big head.
No.
I don't think it will.
No.
But I just appreciate you being here, man. Keep doing what you're doing, brother. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep staying inspired and keep inspiring others and keep fighting the good fight in such an important industry. I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. Like, this has been a ton of fun. Like, I've really enjoyed this time today.
It got a little dusty in the room, not gonna lie, when I started talking about my son. I couldn't help but share that story since it was so relevant to the problem that Andy and his team are trying to solve with hospital infections. I really wanted to make sure I told him to fight on because my family were so directly and deeply impacted by this problem. I love Andy's humility and his heart for people. It truly came through in how he talked about his team and his interns. Keep teaching what you know, Defenders. There's always someone around you who knows a little less than you and desires to know more. Make that investment in someone around you. It's so rewarding. Keep that stamina going too, as Andy mentioned. You will only be rewarded. Zig Ziglar said, "You can have everything in life you want if you will just help others get what they want." So I want to also draw your attention to the Bi-Weekly Bugle, Defenders. If you're not already on the list, I would love to have you there. It's just a great opportunity to try to connect a little more personally with you. I have some notes I put at the beginning of every newsletter just to kind of fill you in on what's going on in my life and with the show and such, as well as superhero announcements, super guest announcements, and also a little usable thought, hopefully usable. I try to share just some things I've learned. Typically, it's tied into the episode and maybe some lessons I've I've learned there. So love to have you there. You can subscribe by going to userdefenders.com/join. I want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing, Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, and Darren Goldsmith for the sensational show notes. I'm excited to announce that in 2 weeks, I have an interview with fellow podcaster, designer, and writer Fimke. No last name needed. Fimke is an amazing, inspiring individual. We dive deep into personal growth as it relates to design and getting things done. So be sure you're subscribed until you don't miss it at userdefenders.com/subscribe. I want to thank you so much for listening, Defenders. And as always, until next time, fight on, my friends.